This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up today, the Christchurch massacre brings new civility to mainstream Australian politics. But can it last through the election? And why do some disadvantaged schools beat the odds with great academic results? A new report looks at what they've got in common.
There's actually a lot of evidence that the most important thing to start off with is to have an orderly and safe learning environment. Particularly for disadvantaged schools, that's a challenge many of them have. And these high-achieving schools have overcome that challenge through building this positive school culture.
For the first time since Friday's terrorist attacks in Christchurch, emergency workers who were first on the scene have been speaking publicly about their experiences. And as questions mount about why the attacker apparently wasn't on anyone's radar, the New Zealand government has announced an inquiry. A warning, Barbara Miller's report contains some graphic details that some listeners may find distressing.
Back in the spotlight, two of the first responders to Friday's attacks hold hands, weep and embrace at a memorial site. Just a few days since they were in the thick of it, vision of them rushing the injured into hospital beamed around the globe as the horror unfolded. But it was what happened inside the mosque that will forever haunt ambulance officer Paul Bennett.
We tried to get our stretcher into the mosque, but we couldn't because there were fatalities in the way. We ended up having to lift the bodies over top of other bodies onto our stretchers.
Paul Bennett went on to describe in distressing detail just how confronting the crime scene was.
There was a river of blood coming out of the mosque. And that's a scene that you don't forget.
For police officers who attended the scene of the attacks, it's a similar story. Chris Carl is the president of the New Zealand Police Association.
They're out there, they're doing their job and they're busy and that helps. But there's a lot of officers that were there on Friday morning and they're now being stood down, and that becomes really hard when they start going through it all in their minds. Some things they saw that no one should ever have to see.
There's been widespread praise for the response to the attacks, but there are questions too. The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has announced an inquiry into their lead-up.
The purpose of this inquiry is to look at what all relevant agencies knew or could or should have known about the individual and his activities, including his access to weapons and whether they could have been in a position to prevent the attack.
Alexander Gillespie, Professor of Law at Waikato University, says warnings about far-right extremism weren't given enough attention.
The two things that you need for a terror attack or a mass killing is, one, a lot of hatred and an ideology that justifies the killing of innocent people, and two is firepower. And I could see in New Zealand that you had a core of people, never large, but just small, but that was all you ever needed. And then I could also see that there were gaps in our firearms law compared to other countries. And to me, those two things made it foreseeable that this kind of thing would happen.
New Zealanders are tapping into their traditions to find healing and strength. But it's increasingly clear there is no going back to the way things were before. This is Barbara Miller in Dunedin, reporting for AM.
Well, as we know now, a video of the Christchurch shootings was streamed live on social media. And that's putting companies like Facebook under pressure to explain what they're doing to stop the spread of extreme content. We're hearing today that the Prime Minister wants the issue discussed at the next G20 meeting in Osaka. So to find out more about the road ahead, I spoke to Dr. Damien Spry, an expert in social media at the University of South Australia.
Unfortunately, it's not clear to anyone, including some of those who work for Facebook, what additionally they might be able to do in order to prevent further incidents like what happened on Friday from occurring. There are technical problems, technical challenges, in that the internet is designed to do the opposite of limiting free speech. And once content is available on the internet, it spreads fast, it spreads wide, it pops up in multiple locations. And especially when you're dealing with a platform like Facebook, which has 2 billion users, it's impossible to monitor all that content all of the time, especially when it's coming live.
So to take a step back for a moment, what have social media companies like Facebook been doing in recent years to counter extremist activity? What sort of tools have they been using?
This first occurred as an issue for Facebook, not around terrorist activity, but around things like child pornography and also about self-harm and live murders. So since then, they've done a couple of things. One is to carefully monitor the spread of child pornography. Not only Facebook, but everyone has been doing this by looking at some of the information that's deeply encoded in the videos and therefore being able to target it like that. But unfortunately, Facebook Live as a service has appeared very quickly and then became popular very quickly. And Facebook has struggled to cope with the volume and, of course, the immediacy of Facebook Live. Now, Facebook has claimed that in response to a number of self-harm videos that they have ramped up the number of people who are involved in content moderation. They are claiming that they've built new automated tools to help them better accomplish their moderation and also some new policies. Now, the thing is, we really need to see what those tools are and what those policies are before we can decide if that's an adequate response.
So on that note, are we seeing enough in terms of regulation that's in place around the world to ensure these companies are doing what they can to stamp out the spread of extremist content?
One of the problems that it faces is these free speech provisions. Of course, you can't prevent content from being uploaded unless you censor the internet, which is not going to be acceptable. Once it is uploaded, then it's almost impossible to take it down before it gets spread at least to a few other users. And then the race is on, and before you know it, it's impossible and you're playing a game of whack-a-mole. I don't think it would have ever been possible to prevent the broadcast in the first place, but the amount of time it took for Facebook to take down the live feed was reportedly at 17 minutes. Some people have suggested that that was too long. Now, until we know exactly the steps that it took take down that footage and prevent its spread, it's impossible for us to know whether that was in fact too long. My view is that that does sound too long to me. Content moderators, I understand, have a lot to be watching all over the world, but 17 minutes of this type of footage should be able to be picked up earlier.
So in your view, what's the next step? What needs to happen now for these social media companies?
Well, I think the first step is a thorough review of their actual policies and procedures. For society to be reassured that the social media companies are doing everything that they can and everything that we require of them, they need to tell us exactly what they are doing. And then the second step would obviously be a review of what other possible legal and technological and regulatory solutions or requirements may be needed.
Social media researcher Dr. Damien Spry from the University of South Australia. Australian politicians have paused for thought after the shootings in Christchurch, and it's raised a question. Could their words be used or twisted to stir up anti-Islamic sentiment? Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
For many, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has been a shiny example of how politicians should respond to events like the Christchurch shootings. But here in Australia, Queensland Senator Fraser Anning's anti-Muslim remarks have distracted from the political leader's messages of condolence. Now the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is calling for unity.
As debate becomes more fierce, I am observing that the retreat to tribalism is increasingly taking over. And for some, extremism takes hold.
Both the white supremacist ideology behind the shootings and Senator Anning's response have sparked debate about whether the words politicians use could be helping to foster these extremist ideas. Labor's Ed Husic was the first Muslim elected to Parliament. He told 7:30 the Christchurch attacks have changed his outlook.
I've previously tried to avoid, you know, always commenting on these type of issues, turn the other cheek. But I have to say, I've personally, after Christchurch, figured no, we have a concerted effort to make in dealing with hate speech.
Yesterday, the Greens accused Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton of fanning far-right sentiment in his comments about immigration. Mr Dutton shot back that they were using the shootings for political gain, making them just as bad as Fraser Anning. Queensland Liberal MP Warren Entsch says pointing fingers at any one person isn't helpful, but he's hoping politicians will be more careful with their words in the lead-up to the federal election.
I hope so. I think, you know, what's happened in the last few days really gives us a great incentive to make sure that we're very measured in the way we deal with these sort of issues. We just need to remember that even with words, there are consequences.
The Christchurch shootings have already had an impact in the New South Wales election campaign. With voters in the state headed to the polls this weekend, debate has reignited around gun laws that have remained largely unchanged for 20 years. The federal election is a bit further off, but University of Sydney politics expert Stuart Jackson says Christchurch could also affect messages about immigration in that campaign.
I think it has taken the wind out of some of the arguments that was coming forward from the government at this point. That doesn't stop some of the more marginal politicians, and here again I'm pointing to Fraser Anning, to Pauline Hanson, to actually continue the rhetoric. And indeed, I received a text this morning saying that only Mark Latham and One Nation will solve immigration. In terms of moderating behaviour, that will occur for a short period, and then we will go back to the kinds of arguments that we've seen prosecuted from Peter Dutton, and for that matter, Scott Morrison when he was Immigration Minister, around the need to control immigration.
As an example of how politicians should conduct themselves, Warren Entsch looked to the New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern.
She has handled it absolutely brilliantly.
But as the anticipated May election draws nearer, politicians will face growing temptation to put political point scoring ahead of more measured remarks.
Alexandra Beach reporting. Penny Wong is the opposition's leader in the Senate. She joins me now. Senator Wong, good morning and welcome to AM.
Good morning.
Can I begin by asking about Senator Fraser Anning? A censure motion will be moved when Parliament resumes next month, but more than a million people have signed a petition to have him removed. Are you looking into what more can be done beyond a censure motion?
Oh, well, he should resign. Clearly he should resign. And look, it is heartwarming to see so many people standing against Mr. Anning. What I would say is I hope that what we take from this tragedy is not just standing against Fraser Anning, a man who's never been elected, who is seeking to peddle hatred in a pathetic attempt to get re-elected. And of course he wouldn't be in the Parliament if Pauline Hanson hadn't put him on a ticket. But I hope that what we do out of this is to stand against hate speech in all its forms. Because that is the lesson, I think, out of this tragedy.
Political nature, political debate, by its very nature, is robust. So how do you draw the line between robust political debate and what's acceptable?
Well, I'm not sure that there is a difference between freedom of speech and hate speech. There is a difference between the robust contest of ideas and attacking a particular group of people because of the colour of their skin or the nature of their faith, and dehumanising them in the way that we have seen. And I think all leaders, political leaders, community leaders, do have to take this moment, not just to grieve, not just to mouth platitudes, but to commit to stand against hatred and hate speech. And regrettably, there have been too many occasions, I think, in this country and in debate over recent years where that has not been sufficiently done. And I hope that we can move from this moment, not just, as I said, not just to change behaviour and grieve for a week, but to change the nature of the way in which we discuss race and faith in this country, and more importantly, to recognise there is a difference between hate speech and freedom of speech.
On that note, I mean, looking beyond Fraser Anning, in a broader sense, do you think the political centre has moved further to the right since you've been in politics?
Yes, I do. I don't think any sort of fair-minded observer watching would think otherwise. I was elected in 2001. It was the Tampa election. And I think since that time we have seen a willingness by some politicians to engage in language or actions which have not been, I think, in the national interest, have not been good for this country. And I hope that what we can do is take this moment, a moment of such sorrow and grief, such tragedy and such horror, and do something with it that is good. And what would be good would be if we understood that all of us, even those in, you know, the right of centre, must stand against hate speech.
Concentrating on the events in Christchurch, social media is a key issue here. The shootings were streamed live online. Mm. In view, your view, is there more social media platforms could be doing to ensure content like this isn't streamed and shared?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they have a responsibility, and I think it's been a responsibility that demonstrably has not been met, certainly on this occasion, and there have been other occasions. So if there are things that should be done, they should be done, and if there are laws that need to be changed, then those need to be considered. I don't think we should allow these platforms to be utilised in ways that even those in charge of them say are not appropriate.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, appealed yesterday for less tribalism, not to divide less but to divide better. What can the opposition do to contribute to a more tolerant political debate?
Well, I think the two points I'd make. The first thing is I hope Mr Morrison's words are backed up by action. And the actions would be two things. They would be in this coming election to ensure that the debate doesn't involve language which is around dog whistling and prejudice. And the second would be to ensure that any preference arrangements that he enters into, that he, like Labor, puts right-wing extremists like Fraser Anning and Pauline Hanson last. That is not what has occurred. We know as recently as the Longman by-election, Pauline Hanson's One Nation was preferenced by the coalition ahead of the Labor Party. Now that does need to stop.
But what about Labor, though? What does Labor need to do?
Well, the second thing I think we can all do is to ensure that, as I said, we stand against hate speech. And we have to say to the Australian people, the Australia that we all have faith in, the Australian values in which we believe, are values of inclusion and acceptance and respect. We have to choose unity over division. We have to choose respect over prejudice. We have to choose hope over fear, and we have to choose love over hate. That is what we have to do as a nation, and that is a job for all of us, whether it's the Labor Party, the Coalition, you in the media, or the whole community. We have to choose the values which we want this country to have, and we have to stand against those that we know tear us apart.
Okay, Senator Penny Wong, thanks for joining us on AM.
Good to speak with you.
You're listening to AM Around Australia. The time now is 16 minutes past 8. New research has identified the policies which make the country's best-performing disadvantaged schools successful. The Centre for Independent Studies says its research lays a framework for disadvantaged schools to improve their performance without increasing spending. But other education experts argue the funding for disadvantaged schools is still inadequate. Eleanor Whitehead has this report.
Students at Melbourne's Kings Park Primary School are technically disadvantaged, but 11-year-old Nadia Al-Sadi feels lucky.
I love all the opportunities, including going to Japan for 10 days and also hosting a student from Japan.
Her school is one of the 18 top-performing disadvantaged primary schools in Australia, according to a new report from the Centre for Independent Studies. It used literacy and numeracy results to find the schools, which included 16 government and 2 Catholic institutions. It did not interview worst-performing schools to shine light on their policies, but found 6 common practices among the best in class, including long-term leadership and teacher collaboration. Blaise Joseph is CIS's Education Research Fellow.
Perhaps the most striking one was school discipline. Particularly for disadvantaged schools, that's a challenge many of them have. And these high-achieving schools have overcome that challenge through building this positive school culture.
Across the world, disadvantaged students do worse academically than their more privileged contemporaries. Mr. Joseph says increased funding hasn't narrowed the divide in Australia. He argues these findings could help reduce persistent inequality.
While of course school funding is important, it's not just a question of how much money is spent, but how it is spent. There isn't a lot of evidence to support the policy of significantly increasing funding for schools in general, and in particular for disadvantaged schools.
But other experts believe funding remains a major challenge. In 2015, a report from the OECD indicated Australia has a bigger gap in resourcing between advantaged and disadvantaged schools than other comparable countries. Peter Goss is School Education Programme Director at the Grattan Institute.
Over the last decade, Australia has put more money into school education, but quirks in the way that the formula works means we've actually been heading in the wrong direction. About 10 years ago, it used to be rare for a non-government school to get more dollars than a comparable government school. Now, that's one in three non-government schools.
In 2017, the Coalition passed a multi-billion dollar school funding bill known as Gonski 2.0, saying it would bring truly needs-based funding. Last year, the government made changes to how that need was calculated. Peter Goss says that should pave the way for improvement.
But still, when non-government schools reach full funding, government schools are likely to be at closer to 91%. That's about $1,500 per primary school student per year.
Back at Kings Park Primary School, Principal Jodie Park agrees her school's success is partly due to increased needs-based funding. She says it has helped deliver better outcomes for her students.
The equity funding that I have received has allowed me to ensure that I have things like smaller class sizes in place, that I have the intervention and support programs to have additional support staff within the classrooms, which I think is certainly a benefit in a disadvantaged school.
The principal of Kings Park Primary School, Jodie Park, ending that report by Eleanor Whitehead. Workers on Nauru have dumped potentially deadly asbestos next to a housing complex for refugees. The ABC has been sent videos showing building material containing asbestos sitting in open shipping containers just metres away from the Fly Camp settlement, and there's evidence the material has been used to build sheds. Pacific reporter Stephen Jedgetts has this exclusive report.
Iranian refugee Eli Shakiba says the shipping containers appeared overnight.
No, I just heard there are containers of asbestos. I went there and I saw those containers. The doors of those containers are open.
Many of Nauru's buildings are riddled with asbestos and the government's on a major drive to remove it. It's meant to be safely disposed of. But instead, in October last year, workers from the Nauru Utilities Corporation put asbestos in shipping containers and dumped them only a few metres away from the Fly Camp settlement, where dozens of refugees are housed. Here's Eli Shakiba again.
I haven't seen any truck or anyone who's going to move them from that place. Construct company knows about that. Everyone knows about that, but nobody cares.
Months later, the asbestos is still sitting there. Videos sent to the ABC show many containers are open and broken material is strewn over the ground. And leaked minutes from a meeting between the Nauru government and Australian government officials reveal that some refugees even tried to use it as a building material.
Some of the refugees are using the asbestos to build sheds, unaware of the dangers of using them. They had to be taken down by some of the Canstruct international workers as the refugees refused to take down the sheds themselves once they were informed of the dangers of using asbestos.
Trevor Torrens from the Asbestos Disease Support Society says the minutes paint a disturbing picture.
Once you start breaking it down, a situation will arise where the fibres will be released, and that's the problem. It gets into the lungs, it stays in the lungs, it develops into a tumour.
Mr Torrens says he can't independently verify the dumped material contains asbestos without testing it, but the risk is clear.
That's a very dangerous situation, and the government over there should take immediate steps to clean up that material. It certainly should not be left around in an open area. It's a recipe for disaster.
In a statement, the Department of Home Affairs says it's raised the issue with Nauru for appropriate action.
The department and its service providers are working to educate residents about the dangers of the material and encourage them to keep away from it until it can be safely removed by the government of Nauru.
Eli Shakiba says refugees on Nauru just want someone to take responsibility and remove the asbestos before more people are exposed.
ABF say this is not our responsibility, this is Nauru government. Nauru government say this is nothing that we can do, you should ask contract. There is no one, none of those stakeholders cares about refugees.
The ABC has called and emailed the government of Nauru seeking comment, but it hasn't replied.
Stephen Jedgetts. One of the figures leading the fight against obesity in Australia has thrown his weight behind a crackdown on junk food advertising. The UK government is moving to ban it before 9 p.m. online and on TV as it tries to address childhood obesity. The food industry here says it's not needed. But with two-thirds of Australian adults and around a quarter of children overweight or obese, Queensland's health minister backs it. Lexi Metherill has this report.
The food industry is not used to getting an ear bashing from politicians, but the Queensland Health Minister, Stephen Miles, is now dishing it out.
Particularly a few multinational companies, by their store placement, by their advertising and by their government relations strategies, are profiting off the misery of obese people.
The Labor MP was appointed to lead the development of a national obesity strategy by the Council of Australian Governments. He's taking a bold approach. He says a sugar tax should be under consideration, but there hasn't been the political will.
That's partly because it's difficult, but also because there is a whole industry of multinational companies who make big profits off the misery of overweight and obese people, and their efforts to stymie efforts to promote healthier lifestyles have ultimately been successful so far.
The federal government acknowledges the limited success of efforts to combat obesity. Meanwhile, the UK is forging ahead in tackling the problem. The country's public health minister has opened a public consultation on a proposal to ban advertising for foods high in fat, sugar and salt on TV and online after 9 p.m. Stephen Miles says Australia should follow suit.
I think it's definitely something that should be considered, and we should watch closely what they do in other countries, including the United Kingdom, and see if it's proven to work there. I think the inclusion of online is very interesting. I think certainly my kids and a lot of young people don't watch traditional television programming, and so if you wanted to protect them better from junk food advertising, you'd need to include online videos.
The food industry says such a move is not necessary. The Australian Food and Grocery Council's chief executive is Tanya Barden.
We already have in place some food and grocery codes of conduct that restrict the advertising to vulnerable groups such as children, and that covers not only television but also online platforms, and that means that companies can only advertise healthy choices during children's programming or during other TV shows where children make up 30% or more of the viewing audience.
But Jane Martin from the Obesity Policy Coalition says the industry's code is not effective.
If you have a code that's set up by industry, which industry oversees and then says it's working very well, we need to be very concerned. What we know is that products like Coco Pops meet the guidelines for healthier food and therefore under their self-regulation can be marketed to children.
AM has asked the federal government for its position on junk food advertising. Federal Labor is understood to be considering restrictions on the advertising of unhealthy food with an announcement planned before the election.
Lexi Metherall reporting. Let's return to Christchurch now. Our reporter Nick Dole is there. He joins me live. Nick, it's a custom in Islam to bury people as soon as possible after they've died. What's happening there at the moment in terms of the burials?
Well, Tom, every effort is being made here to try to lay the 50 victims to rest. But sadly, it has been stalled. Now, we were initially told that it may take a day or two, and that's completely to be expected, really. You've got a huge criminal investigation underway. Forensics teams are still combing the mosques, and obviously there is a victim identification process which is taking place. Australians are involved in that. Now, there's also a process that will need to basically provide the bodies once they are released to the families, and they then need to go through a process, obviously, of washing before burial. The real hold-up has just been in that victim identification process. There was one body that had been released a couple of days ago, but it wasn't appropriate, it turned out, in the end, because the family wanted that person buried with another loved one, and so not even that burial went ahead. We are told that Thursday may be the day. Some reports are that Thursday afternoon there may be quite a few people buried out at the Memorial Park Cemetery, about 5 minutes drive from here, but it's quite a distressing thing for many people who are really just trying to lay their loved ones to rest.
And briefly, Nick, do we get a sense that the gun law changes will be divisive to enforce them in New Zealand?
Look, I think public sentiment is certainly shifting towards some sort of change. There has to be some sort of change. The Prime Minister said that herself. I think one of the key questions will be whether it's an all-out ban on semi-automatics or whether the ban focuses more on those high-level military-style machine guns. We'll find out more from the Prime Minister in the coming days. We're told we'll have details at least before Monday.
Okay, Nick Dole reporting there from Christchurch. Thank you. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Thomas Ariti.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
And today's episode is all about the opioid crisis in the US, which is so bad that it's killing 900 people a week.
And the Sacklers continue to profit off the bodies of 400,000 people.
The federal government is aggressively fighting the opioid epidemic on all fronts.
It's been rolling on for more than 20 years now, but instead of getting better, it's morphing into something more deadly. So how did things get so bad?
That's The Signal. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.